Welcome back to Techonomics. I am your host, Jason Middleton, and we're talking artificial intelligence this week. On some corners of the internet, the reigning question becomes, how hard should we fight against the coming horde of robot overlords? Well, that may seem overblown a bit, although the internet really is great at hyperbole, but there's a vein of real anxiety that's also warranted. Will artificial intelligence, for instance, replace human workers? And how will our economies function if robots are not just doing things for us, but maybe thinking for us too? The first step is realizing AI is built around pattern recognition and data collection. How much data, you may well wonder? Well, think about self-parking sensors in our cars or retinal recognition on our phones. And what about any series of tracking systems on our smartphones that we opt in to using for a more convenient and unique everyday experience? And there's the rub, or at least a major one. The fact that we seem compelled to opt in to feeding our data, our choices, into artificial intelligence engines. That opting in may well be the way to opt out of an apocalyptic version of the future for AI. This is Techonomics. I am Jason Middleton. No, really. Here's part two of our interview with author, technologist, futurist, and optimist Kevin Kelly. We left off with Mr. Kelly choosing whether or not we want to be tracked, digitally speaking. Now, is that tracking something we will comfortably give ourselves over to? Because it seems that it might be able to be exploited. I'm using maybe a health care insurance company or an auto insurance company who tracks the way I drive my Jeep up and down the 24 on my way back and forth to work. Are they going to be able to implicate me in some way or maybe charge me more?
Well, they may even charge you less. I'm actually very eager for the insurance companies to know how I drive, because I'm a very safe driver. I try to drive very carefully, and I should get a discount. You know, right now, people don't realize, but their cars actually do track how you drive. That information is not necessarily accessible to the insurance companies automatically. It's on a little tiny chip in your car, but it could be. And so you could get a discount for driving responsibly. And so I'm eager for that. I think the question about, you know, what happens to all this kind of information is a real big issue that we have to solve. And I think the tracking is inevitable, but I think what kind of tracking is not. And I advocate a version of tracking that I don't think is inevitable. I think it's a choice. And I call it covalent, meaning that it's symmetrical. It goes both ways. It's not surveillance where they're surveilling you or me, but it's covalent in that I am watching who watches me. I am tracking who tracks me. And it's much more akin to, say, life in a small town where everybody knows what you're doing every moment, but you know who they are. You know what they're doing every moment. So there's that co-mutual surveillance. And that is actually something that we evolved and have been comfortable with for millions of years. I mean, humans spent millions of years in small bands where you knew everything about everybody else. And that was something that we just have evolved with, so we are comfortable with that. We're uncomfortable when they know about me and I don't know who they are and I don't know what they know and I don't get any benefit. And that's what we're uncomfortable, and that's what the kind of imbalance that we have to restore with tracking, so that whoever's tracking us, we have to hold them accountable, we have to have access to it, we can correct it, and most importantly, we need to have direct benefit from that.
So sticking to the small village analogy, some of us fled those small villages to larger urban areas for precisely the reason you mentioned at the top. But you're saying that by using our quantified self, we have our own jacket of data that we can better protect ourselves with. Can I nutshell it that easily?
I think quantified self is one aspect of it. But no, what I'm saying is that we want to institute systems so that, for instance, if a company like, say, Google is tracking me, that I have access to that information that Google has about me, that I can verify and hold them accountable for keeping it correct. I can determine what they do with it, whether they pass it on or sell it, and I get some direct benefit from Google for sharing that information. And third, and lastly, and then I have access to Google in some capacity in terms of its mechanism for looking at me, so that I can watch Google. So that's what I mean by that.
I see. Okay. And that also pivots back into Google's launch this week of its AI, its assistant and its home, in that we are interacting with the data that's going to make our lives easier and more comfortable.
Right. So if Google has their AI sitting in my house and it's listening basically all the time, then I want to be able to know what its algorithm, I mean, I know what its design are, what its uses are, what happens to the information. I want to be able to track that. I want to be able to have an account. I want to be able to get access to that information myself if I want to use it. And there should be some very direct, obvious benefit to me for that information that Google is collecting.
Of the 12 tenets in your book, Mr. Kelly, I'm wondering, obviously all of them had your curiosity at one point, but at this moment, which one has the most attention for you? And some of the examples are filtering, which we've talked about a little bit, remixing, interacting, tracking, definitely we've talked about. What one are you most intrigued by right now?
It's a term, a verb that I call cognifying, which is a kind of a fancy word meaning to make things smarter. And we also know it as artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence is something that I think is probably the most profound new force in our lives. I think it's the equivalent of industrialization in the way industrialization transformed our lives from farmers and agricultural age to everything we see around us in our cities and suburbs. And this force is this where we're adding mindfulness, adding smartness, adding intelligence to every aspect of our lives. I think we're underestimating how important it is, even in the short term.
And all of this data that you've been collecting and everything, you still remain an optimist about the coming future and the coming artificial intelligence wave that we will be adjusting to over the next 30 years or so?
Absolutely. It's going to create far more jobs. There are going to be jobs that will go away, but there'll be far more new jobs coming up, far more desires that will help us create. It'll help us crave things that we didn't even know we wanted. It'll allow us to do things we had no idea that we could do. It's going to be amazing in the same way that it would be very hard for the farmers in America 150 years ago, 70% of Americans were farmers, to realize that all their jobs basically were taken away by automation, artificial power, artificial, you know, energy. There's less than 1% of farmers today. And so farmers back then would have said, well, what are we going to do? And they would have been shocked if we told them, well, you're going to become web designers and mortgage brokers and yoga teachers and stuff. And so we're in for the same kind of surprise about what's going to happen once we add these artificial minds to that artificial energy that we've had in the Industrial Revolution, where we have not just a car that drives itself, I mean, that goes down the street by itself, and now it steers itself with the auto-driven car.
Right.
And that is going to be one example in the many that's coming in just the next couple of decades.
Oh, man, I cannot wait for self-driving cars myself. That's just me. I just can't wait.
Yeah, what are we going to do in a self-driving car? We're going to do virtual reality. We're going to put on the headset, and we're going to be in a completely different place. We're going to be at our office working. It's going to be amazing.
We'll have more time for ourselves because we're getting our work done in a more efficient manner, maybe?
Not so much. We may work more, for that matter, because we like the things that we do. It's that we are going to continue to increase the choices that we have. That's what technology gives us, increasing choices. Anybody who wants to work in a same kind of an office that they've always worked in will still have that choice. There'll be companies that will do that. People who want to work at home will do that. People who want to work in Starbucks can do that. People who want to work in their car can do that. We'll have those choices. So most of the old choices will continue. There'll still be mom and pop restaurants, but there'll be new ways to eat as well. That's what technology gives us, increasing choices.
We've been speaking with Kevin Kelly, an author, a technologist, a futurist. He's also author of What Technology Wants. That's his previous book. This one is called The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Mr. Kelly, one last question before I let you go. Philip Dick asked a question, do androids dream of electric sheep? And we've been talking about artificial intelligence. What do you think the answer to that is?
I think they absolutely do. I think one of the things that artificial intelligence is going to teach us is to help us understand the power and the magic and actually the advanced degree to which animals think. intelligence of animals is a lot more complex than we currently understand right now, and we may even be able to, in some way, reach them using AI.
Mr. Kelly, thank you so much for your time.
It's really been a pleasure. Thanks for the great questions.
That was the end of a two-part chat with Kevin Kelly. Mr. Kelly's new book is The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Mr. Kelly co-founded Wired Magazine back in 1993. For links to Mr. Kelly's work, go to facebook.com/techonomicsradio. There you will also find a playlist of this week's music used on the show, as well as a plethora of links on further discussions regarding the coming wave of artificial intelligence. Now, this seems like a good time to run an Ex Machina clip with a Blade Runner clip. But remember, if you get in a room with an artificially intelligent being, revert to human emotion to see if it's lying to you.
Even the artificial trappings of humanness can trigger a physical response.
Are you attracted to me?
You give me indications that you are.
I do?
Yes.
How?
Microexpressions.
Microexpressions?
The way your eyes fix on my eyes and lips. The way you hold my gaze.
This unconscious physical response is, in fact, how humans are distinguished from replicants in the film Blade Runner. The Voight-Kampff test provides a polygraph-like measurement of empathic body responses through such autonomic signals as heart rate and pupil dilation.
All right, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. Just relax and answer them as simply as you can. You're watching television. Suddenly you realize there's a wasp crawling on your arm.
I'd kill it.
You're reading a magazine. You come across a full-page nude photo of a girl.
Is this testing whether I'm a replicant or a lesbian, Mr. Deckard?
Just answer the questions, please.
That's from a YouTube essay about artificial intelligence. It's quite good. The link is at facebook.com/techonomicsradio. Coming up after this short break, we have a young entrepreneur who is tackling a traveler's airport dilemma. Can I get from this terminal to another terminal for a burrito before my connecting flight takes off? Hey, it's a real problem that affects us all. This is Techonomics. I am Jason Middleton. Please come on back after we pay these bills.